Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. All right, each party will have 15 minutes aside, and the appellant may reserve time for rebuttal. We'd ask that you stay at the podium as the proceedings are being recorded. And we have read the brief, so you may want to use your time accordingly and argue your arguments. And finally, if anybody in the courtroom has any cell phones or pagers, please turn those off so as not to interrupt the arguments. And if the attorneys are ready, we're ready to proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning, I'm Hillary Anderson with the law firm Burns, Biegut and Will, bar number 40287, here on behalf of the appellant Reverse Lending Group, LLC. Your Honors, the case before you is one of misapplication. The district court misapplied the current test for equitable subrogation, for no longer is prejudice the sole determining factor. Now, as we know, the bank and Reverse Lending both held deeds of trust against a particular piece of property. In November 2007, the bank mistakenly released that deed of trust and now seeks equitable subrogation to be put back in the first priority position. And Your Honors, I can go into more detail on the facts, but being cognizant of your time, I'm going to move on to my argument if that's okay with each of you. So as we know, equitable subrogation allows a junior lien holder to essentially leapfrog over a senior lien holder to be promoted in priority. It's been used in the past to correct mistakenly released deeds of trust. However, the test for doing so was not entirely clear prior to 2005. Before, it seemed that if there's no prejudice to the junior lien holder, the court would grant subrogation without considering any other factor. That all changed in 2005 when the Supreme Court set forth a number of factors divided into two tests, essentially. There's the first five Hicks factors, which I won't run it through in detail, that last factor being what's important here, and that's a lack of prejudice to the junior lien holder. The court in Hicks said even if those five factors are met, then you must consider whether the party seeking subrogation acted with knowledge, negligence, or sophistication.
Actually, didn't Hicks say something more than that? Didn't it say that you have to consider those last three factors to see whether they were such that application of the doctrine would be inequitable?
Correct, Your Honor, yes.
And doesn't that mean, if you look at the cases, that you look at those three factors and then balance them against the lack of prejudice and see where you come out as a matter of equity?
Correct, Your Honor, but the way the district court decided this case is though they considered these three additional factors, then they went back to prejudice only and made a finding that because there was a lack of prejudice in this case to grant subrogation. And in the Hicks case, it specifically says, even assuming you don't have any prejudice, these three factors, which in this case are all present, can preclude equitable subrogation. In this case, they should have.
But does Hicks say that it must preclude it or that it can preclude it based on how the court balances the equities?
Correct. It can preclude it. You're correct, Your Honor. So in this case, those three factors should have precluded equitable subrogation. Here, as the district court found, it assumed that the bank acted with the maximum degree of sophistication, and there's no denial that the bank knows how these transactions work and the repercussions for releasing a deed of trust. The district court also found that the bank acted negligently. Not only were they negligent in marking that note paid in full, but also recording the release and then waiting 3 months before filing a substitutive deed of trust. And if that wasn't enough, contrary to what the district court found, as it found that it was undisputed that the bank did not act with the requisite level of knowledge, which since the very beginning, Reverse Lending contested that and said that the bank did act with the requisite level of knowledge, and the bank even admitted that on its briefs for summary judgment.
So let me understand your argument. So is it your position that if those factors are found, negligence or sophistication, that automatically then it dictates the result, or is it context specific?
It's a case by case basis, Your Honor. In this case, though, the bank is that large commercial sophisticated party and at some point needs to be held accountable for its actions and follow the rule of law. In this case, it should not have made a mistake like this.
But why is that necessarily the case when you have a case like this one where it's also undisputed that there was no prejudice, no detrimental reliance by Reverse Lending? Why can't the court, in its equitable powers, which is what Hicks said these cases were all about, weigh those and say, well, yeah, I know it's a sophisticated lender, but in this case, I'm going to look at the equities the other way. Why is that error? I mean, maybe the court could have come out the other way, and that wouldn't have been error either, but I don't understand why it's necessarily an error here just because of the fact that you have a sophisticated lender.
2 points to address that question, Your Honor. One being, again, that the test, at least how the Hicks court set out, is prejudice can, if the district court found solely on prejudice, then it renders that 8-factor test down to 1 factor. And in this instance, prejudice aside, the bank should not be rewarded for its negligence. It is a sophisticated party, and the Hicks court even stated subrogation is never a reward for negligence.
Well, it really doesn't reduce that test down to 1 factor by just finding that there was no prejudice, because the court said that it assumed that this was a sophisticated lender. It assumed that the lender had knowledge, and it assumed that it was negligent in negligent in releasing its deed of trust. So it's not just one factor of prejudice that the court is relying on, is it?
They considered the other factors, but they went back and said, even, you know, considering that there is negligence and sophistication in this case, because there is no prejudice, so that they based its decision solely on prejudice. Since there is no prejudice, we are going to grant subrogation in this case. And under the test in Hicks, we believe that is the incorrect result. And, Your Honor, just to touch briefly, I know the bank brings up in their briefs the subordination agreements. A few points on those. The bank specifically elected equitable subrogation in this case as their remedy. Contracts play no role in equitable subrogation. That's conventional subrogation when you consider contracts. That aside, those subordination agreements terminated when the bank marked its note paid in full and recorded its release. As far as reverse lending was concerned, at that point, the debt had been paid in full. If for some reason it is determined that the subordination agreements are still in effect, they're either void because they lack a material term, that being a termination term, or they're ambiguous, requiring further factual findings by the district court. So, Your Honors, for these reasons, because there are 8 factors in the test and because the district court cannot base its decision solely on prejudice 1 factor, we ask that you reverse the district court's grant of the bank's motion for summary judgment and the denial of reverse lending's cross motion for summary judgment, as equitable subrogation fails as a matter of law here. Thank you.
Under your argument, would not your client receive a windfall under your argument and what you want us to do?
And that's a great question, Your Honor. As reverse lending bargained to have their loan paid off, they also bargained if they were in the second priority position, if the bank ever released their deed of trust, they would be put in the first priority position. So it's not a windfall in the essence that they expected to have their loan paid off or entitlement to the property with their deed of trust if the loan was defaulted on. So in that essence, reverse lending does not receive a windfall. Are there any further questions? Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. George Berg, B-E-R-G, registration number 022556, and with me this morning are Heidi Potter and Kim Tomey, who helped out on the briefing. This is not a case of hyper-technical legal analysis. This is a case of equity and fundamental fairness. And the issue before this court, and based upon your questions, you have dealt with many of the issues that I want to address in the argument. First of all, equity is a balancing of interests. And the specific balancing in this case is just what you just referred to, Your Honor, the unjust enrichment sought by reverse lending versus a punishing of Colorado Capital, if you will, for what was basically a simple mistake. The applicable case law, I think, requires a determination in Colorado Capital's favor, and I don't think a clearer case could have been made. In this case, Greentree, the case that's been cited primarily by the appellant, does not change the Hicks ruling. The Hicks ruling, as you so noted, is one in which it is a balancing of a lot of different equitable factors. You go through the five primary Hicks factors, and as counsel said, then you come to the issue of, after you get through those five Hicks factors, is there something that is so egregious in the behavior of the primary claiming, the subrogor who is claiming a subrogated position, is there something in their behavior that would not allow an outcome in their favor or in the favor of equitable subrogation to be fair? And simply in this case, there isn't that kind of behavior, primarily because as soon as the bank, Colorado Capital Bank, realized the mistake that had been made, they put the world on notice by recording a notice in the real property records that, in fact, the deed of trust had been mistakenly released, put the world on notice, or inquiry notice at least, that they should determine whether, in fact, the lien had been paid. And obviously, it had not. And just a brief aside to the subordination agreement, the actual contract that was executed between the two parties to this case, the subordination agreement does not provide that in a mistaken release of the deed of trust or in a mistaken statement that the indebtedness was paid, that in fact the subordination agreement will terminate. I agree with counsel that the contract issue of the subordination agreement is not really before this court, except in the instance of looking at all the overall Hicks factors and what's fair. They agreed to be subordinated to the lien of Colorado Capital Bank until it was paid, and that's what is provided. Now, the fact that an erroneous statement that it was paid in terms of the release of the deed of trust was filed of record does not rise to the level of it actually having been paid, and that's what the subordination agreement provides for. There's no harm to reverse in this instance. They agreed to be subordinated. They were subordinated. Equitable subrogation in this case is kind of interesting because equitable subrogation just puts Colorado Capital back into the lien position they had before the release. That lien position, as a matter of the Recording Act and the timing of the lien, was recorded after the reverse lending liens. And so it actually takes the subordination agreement to create the fact that reverse lending is an intervening lien holder. Therefore, there is no detriment to them whatsoever. In all of the cases since Hicks, the primary issue, even though the Hicks case says you consider certain things if all five of the Hicks factors are met, there was harm suffered by either the intervening lien holder and or some third party. And we just don't have that here. In the balancing, there's going to be a $300,000 detriment to Colorado Capital if it has to step in and pay off the reverse lending indebtedness. There was no harm because Colorado Capital filed a notice of the fact that the lien had been inadvertently and mistakenly released. No funds could have been advanced. The reverse lending was protected from advancing further funds, either in the form of more money to the borrower, attorney's fees in terms of pursuing a foreclosure. There was no detriment whatsoever to them before they got notice of the fact that the indebtedness had been, or the deed of trust had been inadvertently released.
Mr. Berg, let me ask you about the trial court's order for a moment. Trial court determined that there was knowledge, negligence, and the third factor, but then indicated, but because there's lack of prejudice, there was that equitable subrogation would be appropriate in this situation. Was that the appropriate test?
I think it is the appropriate test, but the problem is that what the trial court found in its order, the type of negligence the trial court found, is that they made a mistake. They should have caught that. But in order for negligence, the cause of action for negligence, which is what I think is being talked about in Hicks, there has to be damage to somebody. It doesn't rise to legal negligence without somebody being damaged. And in these cases, when the negligence of the of the party who inadvertently released the deed of trust is considered, yeah, it was a mistake. It was a mistake that should have been caught. And the trial court acknowledges that. But the trial court then goes on to say that it didn't result in any harm. And so it wasn't really actionable negligence. And the Holt case, actually, which is an older case, but the Holt case really requires that there be some sort of harm. So it's an interesting question as to whether prejudice or detrimental reliance or damages or harm in terms of an actionable for actionable negligence is still a requirement. But I think the cases indicate that the one consistent issue in all of the cases is that somebody had to suffer, either a third party bidder at the foreclosure sale, or the intervening lien holder had to have paid some money out, have taken some action in reliance upon a belief that this had been truly released. Now, there's none of that in this case, and for that reason, I think when you consider all of the Hicks factors, the first five that it takes to get to the test, and then you consider the additional issues of equity that are involved in this case, a clearer case could not be made. Any further questions?
I have a question, Mr. Byrd. The court found that it is undisputed that Colorado Capital acted without the kind of knowledge pertinent to the inquiry regarding equitable subrogation. Can you explain to me what your client's position is with regard to what the court meant by that statement, with this kind of knowledge?
Yeah, I think the type of knowledge that you're talking about is the kind of knowledge that would have put my client on notice that there was a potential for harm to have occurred to intervening lien holders. Okay, remember, the appellant only became an intervening lien holder by virtue of the subordination agreement. So in terms of my client's knowledge, my client still had the subordination agreement to rely upon, so they weren't concerned about hurting anyone. The notice that was filed, if you want to take an inference, the notice that was filed of record to put the world on notice that in fact this deed of trust had been released in error was to protect all people, not just an intervening lien holder like reverse lending. Reverse lending was subordinated by agreement, and when you consider that as one of the factors, not for purposes of making a determination of what that contract does, but just in consideration of the overall equity of this case, that's in my mind what the court is talking about in terms of knowledge. In the Greentree case, the lender who had paid off and then had paid off the underlying liens, the prior liens, but then had not had the intervening lien holder pay off the line of credit, they ran stop sign after stop sign after stop sign. And it's that kind of knowledge that not asserting your right at an appropriate time will result in a waiver of that right. And that's really what I think the court was balancing in Greentree, is that they had many opportunities to step in and protect against this, and they just didn't do so. And that's the type of behavior that results in this issue of knowledge. They were on notice that a prejudice might occur, and they didn't do anything about it. In our case, my client did exactly what they should have done. They immediately filed a notice, put the world on notice of the issue that it was inadvertently released. Any further questions?
Oh, I do have one further question. In dealing with knowledge, negligence, or degree of sophistication, the court uses the term or. And so right now you're talking about the type of behavior being so egregious. So if it could just be that a degree of sophistication could be sufficient enough, what would be your response to that?
I don't think sophistication is in and of itself a linchpin, if you will, for a determination of this case. The banks are sophisticated, if you will. People still make mistakes. It doesn't make any difference how sophisticated you are. I mean, the libraries of the law schools are full of books with appellate decisions in them where somebody was determined to have made a mistake, right? People make mistakes. It's what you do after you know about the mistake in terms of protecting the rest of the world against harm. And in this instance, that's what our client did, was protected the world against harm. So when you consider this overarching issue of equity, that's why I say that this is really not a hyper-technical case, but it is one of balancing. And you have to consider all of the factors. And when you do in this case, I think the outcome is clear. Thank you.
Your Honor, just a few points in closing here. Again, those subordination agreements terminated when the bank released its deed of trust. As far as reverse lending was concerned, the debt had been paid at that point. And they play no part in the Hicks factors or in any of the factors that the Hicks court set forth in determining whether equitable subrogation should be granted. Another, the district court, as Your Honor specifically mentioned, that the district court found it was undisputed that the bank acted without the requisite level of knowledge. And that knowledge is actual knowledge of a junior lien, not actual knowledge of whether somebody may be harmed or some other circumstances, actual knowledge of a junior lien.
Well, let me just stop you there. Even if you assume that that's what the district court meant, and I think that that sentence in the district court's order is subject to, quite frankly, all kinds of interpretations in terms of what they meant. But let's assume that the district court, whether they got it right or got it wrong, that the undisputed facts are that Colorado Capital knew about reverse lending's lien. And I think that is what the record shows. They did know about it. They knew about it from the very beginning when they refinanced this loan. So why can't we as an appellate court take that undisputed fact and see whether balance it against prejudice and all the other factors here and decide whether the court erred as a matter of law in concluding that equity supported application of the doctrine here?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what the court should do, is consider knowledge, negligence, and sophistication in their factors. And at least, you know, if the district court's order stands where it based its decision solely on prejudice, then the court, we ask that this court or either the Supreme Court clarify this test for equitable subrogation, because as you mentioned, these factors should be considered, and in this case, they preclude equitable subrogation. You know, I think there's a very good reason that the Supreme Court set forth these eight factors, and that's that fundamental principle that those who seek equity must do equity. And those additional three factors go to that, is that party who's seeking equity doing equity? And here, the bank is this large, sophisticated party, and especially today, you know, how we have these companies constantly making careless mistakes and asking the courts to come up here and clean up their messes and bail them out, essentially. And at some point, these types of parties have to be accountable for their actions. And that's why, in this case, we believe that those additional three factors, if considered under the appropriate test, preclude subrogation in this case, regardless if there's prejudice to any other party. So again, we ask that you reverse the district court's order for summary judgment.
I have a question, Ms. Anderson. How is Colorado Capital Bank and its commission of an error not doing equity? What is Colorado Capital Bank doing that's inequitable to reverse lending?
Aaron, I think it's not only reverse lending, but maybe any party or society in general, that it should be held accountable for these types of actions that it takes, and it should know better and should know what it means to release a deed of trust and take care in taking those kind of actions.
Well, who is hurt here?
Your Honor, at this point, no one. I mean, reverse lending did not get what they bargained for as far as they're not getting their loan paid off. They're not being promoted to the first priority position once the bank released its deed of trust.
But the law makes clear that that's not enough, doesn't it? I mean, that we've got tons of cases prior to Hicks and after Hicks saying it's not enough that you don't get to leapfrog, that you're right where you were to begin with. So other than that, who was hurt?
There's no other prejudice besides that, but considering again on the additional three factors, subrogation should have been denied in this case. Any further questions I may answer? Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you for your excellent arguments, and the case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.